This is Unicopia Green Radio with your host, Farron Dancer.
Welcome to Unicopia Green Radio. This is your host, Farron Dancer. And, you know, I'm here every Saturday in Santa Fe at 4 p.m. on KTRC Talk 1260. And Unicopia Green Radio is brought to you each and every week by Unicopia, a public benefit nonprofit organization that is dedicated to the awareness, knowledge, and synergy that is key to our sustainable future. And each week, we also like to talk about sustainable thought. And I hope you're not getting sick of that topic, but, you know, if you're thinking positively, then you won't be. And sustainable thought is something I refer to as staying positive, being grateful, projecting the future that we want to create, and living from that future right now so that we're lining up with the sustainable future that we're looking to create individually, collectively, and for the planet. And I want to remind the listeners to go to unicopia.org. That's our website. That's UNICOPIA. And why don't you give us a little support, because this show is sponsored by Unicopia. We try to stay sponsor-free beyond nonprofit contributions. When you go to the website, you'll not only see a couple years of archived radio shows, but you'll see all the different activities and the mission of what Unicopia is involved with. So dial it up, join in, become a member, and send us some support. I want to just break down Unicopia. UNI is the unity consciousness, or the working together, that will create the prosperity, and that's the copia piece, for us individually and collectively, and for the future of the planet. So with all that said, we're going to talk about the future of the planet. We're going to talk about how farming, obviously impacts us all, because we have to eat and we have to live and thrive. And we have a very compelling guest today, Joel Salatin. He is a farming and soil expert supreme, and he has a very renowned farm called Polyface Farm, 550-acre farm. And we're going to talk with Joel about all of his expertise in the world of farming. And he will be presenting at the Carbon Economy Series. And go to www.carboneconomyseries.com. to see all the latest in the lineup of people that are coming in to teach the workshops. And Joel will be here in Santa Fe on November 9th and 10th to teach his particular workshop. And now, drum roll, Gino. Thank you. Joel Salatin on the line. Hey, Joel, where am I talking to you from?
I'm sitting in my office here in the farmhouse in Swope, Virginia, which is smack dab in the middle of the Shenandoah Valley in Virginia.
Shenandoah Valley in Virginia. Well, I haven't done an interview from there before, and I'm stoked to be doing it today. So,
cool.
Welcome to the show, Joel.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
Well, thank you. Joel, I Googled your name earlier this morning, and you even come up on Wikipedia. You're sort of an icon. Can you give the listeners a little bit of your background and what brought you to this place of being a bit of a guru around how to farm right?
Well, I always wanted to farm as a little kid growing up on the farm. My mom and dad bought this place in 1961. Mom was a school teacher, health and phys ed. Dad was an accountant, never certified, but did, you know, accounting, tax preparing and accounting for people. And we had this farm, and it never made a living, but it was a great place to grow up. And I just caught that farming bug, and I wanted to farm full time. So after, you know, a lot of consideration, I stayed on the farm, went to college, came home, worked at a local newspaper, and as a journalist, and then, you know, was able to finally get onto the farm full time, and have been here ever since. It was very nip and tuck in those early years. I mean, we drove a $50 car. We lived in an apartment up in the attic of the farmhouse, Teresa and I, when we got married. And, if we didn't grow it, we didn't eat it. I always said if we could grow toilet paper and Kleenex, we could pull the plug on society. You know, we just devoted ourselves to this. And what happened was, wow, it was successful. And you know, people started hearing about it, seeing about it. I got written up in a couple magazines, and then, you know, it just snowballed from there. You know, it was a wonderful thing, but the tragedy is that it's so uncommon. You know, we would like to see, you know, thousands and thousands of farmers duplicate this.
And obviously you're putting out some effort to promote it so that more and more farmers come in and take your lead. So have you had much success in the outreach, and have there been other farms that have been established as a result of your efforts?
Oh, yes. Well, what happened then was as we began, you know, kind of got some magazine articles written about us and things, we got asked to speak at conferences and stuff, and the phone started ringing. How do you do this pastured poultry thing? What's a pastured poultry shelter look like? How do you build it? Those sorts of things. And
so, what kind of shelter is that again?
A pastured poultry shelter. This is a portable shelter. So the chickens are on the ground, uh-huh. but the house is completely portable and floorless. So you move the house every day, and the chickens walk on the pasture to the next spot.
Wow.
And
what's the benefits of that?
Well, the benefits are, A, the chickens, you know, get fresh air, sunshine, exercise, bugs, worms, grass. Mainly they get grass. Plus, of course, they get their, you know, their grain like they would in any situation. But uh-huh. The main thing is that they're getting all this exercise, sunshine, fresh air, bugs, grass, and a more natural, you know, production system, so that it has a dramatic effect on the nutritional qualities. Including the omega-3, the polyunsaturated fats, all those, you know, qualities from the bird itself. So it's a completely different kind of food than a confinement factory type of chicken.
And then the food source for that chicken is completely different then too, right?
I'm sorry.
The food source that obviously the chickens left to eat bugs and grass and things that they would just get typically feed in a commercial.
They get a much more diversified diet, and they get actually a lot of salad bar, which, you know, the green material is the key to all of the, you know, all of the vitamin mineral profile.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, it's all part of it. And so in my naivety, as people started asking me, how do you do this? I said, well, I'll just write a little manual, and then they'll quit calling. You know?
So, little did you know, right?
Little did I know. So in 1991, I wrote a little manual, sold it through Stockman Grass Farmer magazine, where I was writing some columns,
uh-huh.
and it just sold really well. So in 93, I came out with the Pastured Poultry Prophets book. It's a, you know, a 450-page book, and then. You know, then 2 years later, the Salad Bar Beef book, and, you know, then You Can Farm, Family Friendly Farming, and, you know, these books just came off as I responded to what I considered, you know, the hot button of the day,
uh-huh.
As I, you know, started speaking and talking around.
I see. So just the inquiries prompted you to consolidate your thoughts, put it into
yes.
the written form, and then thinking you'd get them off your back, though, right?
Yes, and of course, you know, it just stimulated more and more discussions, and then people started duplicating it. I mean, there are now thousands, and there's an entire American Pastured Poultry Producers Association, APPPA, that's a national organization to promote, educate, and inform people about the pastured poultry production model, both, you know, consumers and producers. So it's been fun to, you know, to be a part of that, you know, that what I call that whole integrity food tsunami.
Integrity food tsunami, and it's expanding and growing as we speak, do you think?
It is. Yeah, there's certainly a lot more interest today in where food comes from. I mean, you know, I grew up in the 60s and 70s there when we were, you know, in a love affair with these newfangled TV dinners and Velveeta cheese and
I was raised on that stuff. That's why we're all into instant gratification, right?
Yeah, you know, food that you can't pronounce, food that won't rot. You know, you squeeze it out on the table, it sits there, it doesn't mold, doesn't turn sour, doesn't do anything, it just sits there because it's got.
And doesn't do anything for the person eating it either, right?
No, it certainly doesn't. I mean, a food that won't rot won't digest. I mean,
yeah, yeah, they didn't tell you that part, right?
But, you know, the culture at that time was enamored of essentially, you know, getting out of the kitchen, giving us time for soccer and Hollywood.
Right.
And, you know, we were in a love affair with subcontracting out our culinary expertise to big corporate enterprises, and here we are 20, 20, 30 years later with type 2 diabetes, obesity, E. coli, salmonella, you know, a host of problems
right.
that have been created as a result of shortcutting ecology's profit and loss statement.
I want to remind the listeners, if you have a chance to eat a chicken that's been to a salad bar, it's going to really help not only the nutritional value, but probably the flavor, too, I would imagine, right?
Oh, yeah, the flavor, I mean, the texture is a lot, it's not as mealy. It actually has structure to it. Yeah, and the taste, I mean, you don't have to smother it up with sauces and spices and all that. Is it actually has a taste.
Wow. So, you know, letting the animals do their thing, I guess, is part of a theme of your farming technique. Is that true?
Yes. Well, we promote letting appreciating the pigness of the pig and the chickenness of the chicken as being, you know, part of the ethical, moral boundary around human cleverness. You know, in our culture, we are an extension of the Greco-Roman Western reductionist, linear, compartmentalized, individualized, systematized, fragmented, disconnected, parts-oriented kind of thinking.
Wait a minute. I'm going to have to go to break, but when I come back, I'm going to have you repeat that because I got to hear it a second time myself. So I want to invite the listeners to stay tuned, and we'll be back in just a moment.
I endure it for Iva. If you are the big tree, we are the small.
Welcome back. This is Farron Dancer on Unicopia Green Radio, and I want to invite the listeners to pick up a copy of the Greenfire Times. Greenfire Times is available on newsstands throughout northern New Mexico, the fifth largest circulation of any publication in New Mexico, and it's all about the stuff that we're interested in here on Unicopia Green Radio and people who are involved with the environment and sustainability in general. Really enjoy picking up a copy of this, so why don't you join in and be one of them? And, you know, I write a column monthly for the Greenfire Times, and in this October issue currently is the article I call The Prodigious Power of Our Beliefs. So you might want to believe in picking up a copy and reading about that, and give us some feedback if you'd like, and you can contact me, farron@unicopia.org. And I'm on the line here from the Shenandoah Valley in Virginia, and I don't frequent there very often, but, you know, virtually we can go anywhere. And I have on the line Joe Salatin. And, Joel, fascinating topic. I love your spirit and your whole approach to farming. And before the break, you laid down an interesting set of words and parameters for how this thing moves forward. I'm going to have you repeat it, and I know it can never be done the same twice, so that'll give the listeners a little added something.
Sure, sure. Well, you know, you got to realize that our culture, you know, we live in a extension, a natural extension of the Greco-Roman Western reductionist, linear, compartmentalized, fragmentized, systematized, parts-oriented, disconnected kind of thinking.
Right.
And what that does is it views life from a mechanical perspective.
Uh-huh.
In other words, like a big tinker toy with parts attached.
Right.
As opposed to the pig or the tomato or whatever having any dimension beyond mechanical, as just inanimate piles of protoplasmic structure to be manipulated, however cleverly hubris can imagine to manipulate it.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I would suggest that a culture that views its life from that kind of arrogant, disrespectful perspective.
For the holistic nature of things.
Yes,
right?
We'll view its citizens the same way and other cultures the same way. It's how we respect and honor the least of these. It creates an ethical, moral boundary about, you know, how we honor and respect the greatest of these.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, the Thomas of Tom and the Maryness of Mary extends directly in thought. I appreciated your top of the hour, your sustainable thought idea. You know, as a man thinketh, so is he. You know, that's what the Bible says. As you think, your paradigm, your worldview, your thought process defines the actions of your day-to-day living.
And the outcomes or the manifestations of your day-to-day living as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, those are the physical manifestations of your thought process.
Mm-hmm.
So in your thinking, when you view life as fundamentally a mechanical rather than a biological thing, then you're going to, you know, you're going to act in a certain way.
Mm-hmm. And that certain way isn't really in tune with how nature interacts and creates things in synergy with other aspects of life. It becomes, like you say, too compartmentalized. And when you break it down that way, you lose picture of the whole function of how life comes into play, you know. So fascinating.
Well, yeah, I mean, a great example is in our culture now where we don't connect the dots, for example, with what we eat and how we feel. You know, we've come to a point in our in our thinking that we assume if I get sick, I must be pharmaceutically disadvantaged.
Right. And when I went to a baseball game recently and had beer and donuts, I thought, my God, no wonder I feel this way. So at least I had some connection to what I ate and why it affected me, you know?
Right, right. And I'm not saying that having, you know, a beer and donuts is sin.
No, of course not.
But you can't do it. You can't do it every day.
Right. You can't do it every day. But when you do it, and at least in my instance, I knew that based on the garbage that I ate, why I felt the way I felt. Okay.
Right. So. Right. Exactly. You can't. But in our country right now, we don't connect those dots. I mean, we don't connect the dots between processed food, how we feel. We don't connect the dot between cheap food and high health costs.
Mm-hmm.
We don't connect the dot between applying chemical fertilizer to the soil that kills the soil life and earthworms, and the fact that so much food has far less nutrition than it did 40 years ago. You know, all of those things are what I call our ecological womb's profit and loss statement, and we don't have that. You know, we get it in the paper every day. You got the business section with the Wall Street Report, you know, how the Dow Jones is doing up or down and so many points, that sort of thing.
Right.
But, you know, wouldn't it be cool if there were one on an opposing page that gave you an ecology profit and loss statement, whether it was up or down?
Mm-hmm. Well, and in the culture, too, you know, the tuning out of what we eat and feeling a certain way, and then if you feel a certain way and it ain't great, then you just take another pharmaceutical so you'll feel better, and then the compounds from there, and then people are dying young. So what do you say? How about a more natural approach to living, and one whereby nutrition supplies us with the feel-good that we're looking for, right?
Right. That's right. Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, in the final analysis, where you are, you know, in a healthy standpoint is a direct, a physical object lesson or a manifestation of everything that you've eaten. And in our country right now, people are far more concerned about the purity of the gasoline for their car than the purity of the food that they're eating.
You know, just speaking of gasoline for the car, you mentioned when you started out back in the 60s, you had a $50 car. Of course, it costs way more than that for me to fill up my truck today. So we've come a long way in terms of fossil fuel running the game and everything. And I want to get into the emphasis on healthy grass as being symbiotic, the symbiotic cycle of feeding, you know, and that's an area whereby I know you said the chickens eat grass, and we don't normally think of the chickens eating grass. So I want to get into that topic. We're coming up on break, so I'll save it for the next segment. But I find that fascinating. And then the thing about moving not only the chicken coop around, but moving cows from pasture to pasture, and this movement of the animals throughout the farm creates, how would you say it, a living soil as a result of that? What's the real benefit there?
Well, at its most basic level, it is a mimicking of the natural pattern. But yeah, what it does is it closes the carbon cycle, because the carbon cycle in nature doesn't get broken and carbon doesn't get moved very far.
Mm. So when we move the animals around the farm, then how is that feeding this integrative approach?
Well, yeah, what it does is that it drops the manure and urine from the animals, which is the way nature fertilizes soil and builds soil, nearby the place where it was harvested in a continuous cycle. And the animals then, because we are strategically managing when they have access to the grass then is allowed to go through its blaze of growth period, so it actually harvests more solar energy into decomposable biomass than it would in a static state of either non-grazing or overgrazing.
Okay, well, hold that thought with overgrazing, because I've got to go to break, and we'll pick it up in just a moment here on Unicopia Green Radio.
Oh, yeah. Keep on knocking. Keep on knocking. It's been a long, long time since I've got you on.
Welcome back. This is Farron Dancer on Unicopia Green Radio, and I'm on the line from the Shenandoah Valley in Virginia with Farmer Supreme, Joel Salatin, who's written countless books on how to do farming in a holistic and synergistic way. And I'm using that word because I like that word, Joel.
Yes, it's a great word.
Oh, thank you. And before the break, we were talking about the movement of, you know, moving the chicken coop and moving the cows from pasture to pasture. And one of the things I picked up on was the fact that you're allowing the grasses to regenerate by giving them a break from hanging out with the animals. And then they can use the nutrients from the excrement, the urine, the manure, and then thrive in terms of growing new grasses, and then the chickens and cows are off doing it somewhere else. So that's kind of how that gets going, right?
Yeah, well, in natural patterns, the grass actually is sequestering or it's metabolizing more solar energy into carbon, into biomass that sequester carbon, actually faster than trees. We as a nation right now of Americans in our highly developed country, supposedly developed, we are kind of brain damaged when it comes to grass. When we think of grass, we think either golf course or lawn.
Right.
But when we think about grass on the Serengeti, we think about grass on the American Plains, Little House on the Prairie, what was here in the Shenandoah Valley, 500 years ago. It's grass that's like 12 feet tall, thick as hair on a dog's back, and you know, 3/4 of an inch thick at the base, this tall, waving mountains of carbon.
Well, we don't see grass like that very often nowadays, right?
No, we don't today, because grass is not, you know, is not high on the agenda of important things, but grasslands around the world are what have built all the deep soils around the world, have been from grasslands, not from forest or brush. So because it does have a much faster, a solar biomass cycle. So in nature, the herbivore, whether it's a yak, a wildebeest, a buffalo, a giraffe, a cow, a sheep, goat, the herbivore is what prunes the grass back so that it doesn't go into senescence, but restarts the rapid biomass accumulation of what I call the teenage, you know, the teenage years. If you overgraze, then you stunt the ability of the photosynthetic activity to occur. If you undergraze, it all turns brown and shuts down and goes into senescence, what I call nursing home phase. So what we want to do is, just like a viticulturalist would prune a vineyard or an orchardist an orchard, the herbivore prunes the grass to restart the biomass accumulation. But if the herbivore comes back to it and regrazes too soon before it has had time to reaccumulate the energy that was expended in sending forth the new, you know, the new growth, the new shoot, then the grass plant is weakened, and that's what we see in overgrazing.
I see. So you have to give the land a break in between.
Yes, exactly. Okay. So it's this pulsing. We call it pulsing of the grass, where you have one day on and then many days off, and one day on, many days off. So, you know, we may not touch a given square yard, but 2 or 3 days in a whole year, and you have these long rest periods to let it come to physiological expression, make a seed head and get real tall and big and go to complete, you know, phenotypical expression before it gets grazed back. And this not only produces way more nutrition for humans, you know, in meat or milk, but it also develops soil even faster than, you know, than fire and herds of herbivores have been able to do in their regular natural static state.
Let me ask you, I've looked into this a little bit in the past, and one of the things I remember reading about was that when the cows go into a pasture situation and they're not left there too long to really, you know, damage all of the grass and crunch everything down, but leaving hoof prints in the soil ends up being like little cups that holds water and eventually is of benefit to the overall production or regeneration of the grasslands. Is there a piece like that too, where the cows, if they don't hang out too long, are of benefit on that level as well, aside from the grazing piece?
Yes. What you're talking about is the timing. Timing, as you know, whether you're telling a good joke or running a landscape, timing is everything.
Uh-huh.
And so, so what would be very destructive if left to go on for a long, long time can be extremely beneficial. I mean, let's take a good example out of our own lives, you know, fasting. Fasting can be extremely beneficial, but you can't do it for an extended period of time.
Right, or you won't be around to talk about it.
So the herbivore coming into a piece of grassland, chomping it down quickly, and exiting, that very short period of disturbance is a freshening up and stimulates successional ecological activity, whether it's hydrologic cycles like you're talking about with the little hoof prints that form cups to hold rainwater,
mm-hmm.
or whether it's the pruning that I talked about earlier. All of that kind of the hoof action actually chips the little edges off the grass plants to stimulate additional side tillering so that the soil gets covered with more and more vegetation. All of that occurs when we mimic the way a natural mob moves across the landscape in a very short stay period. We call this mob stocking, herbivorous solar conversion, lignified carbon sequestration, fertilization.
Oh, wow. Okay, I'm going to ask you to say that one more time.
Yeah, I can do that.
Okay.
Sure, it's called mob stocking, herbivorous solar conversion, lignified carbon sequestration, fertilization.
And that is basically the definition of the movement.
Yes.
In the proper timing of the movement.
Yes,
right?
Exactly. With the group tightly controlled, and of course our tool is electric fence. We don't have wolves, we don't have fire, but we do have very high-tech electric fencing.
Okay.
And so we use portable electric fencing to define where they're going to be for 24 hours, and every 24 hours we move that group of herbivores on to another spot, and then where they were is allowed a long rest period before they come back to it.
So do you actually just have fenced off pastures where you can just open the gate, move the herd into the new pasture, close the gate, and then it's electrified from there? Is that how it works?
Yeah. What you have is a network of permanent electric fencing, and this is, when I say electric fencing, this is one strand. So we just have a permanent a grid of that, and then you can subdivide with little portable runs. So you might have a field that's, you know, X number of acres, and then you subdivide that into what are called smaller paddocks. And the beauty of this is that it's so economically beneficial that it pays for the extra management it takes to make it happen. So, you know, so many people say, oh, this, you know, that, man, moving cows every day, that sounds like it'd take too much time, and it's all this work and effort and all this. But in actuality, it pays a huge amount per hour. I mean, we've calculated it here at least 60 and sometimes 100 bucks an hour. We get paid back in additional production due to controlling the access of the animal on a given spot at a given time to let the grass go through this very rapid biomass accumulation cycle.
Wow, and you've actually been able to break it down so you can figure it out by the hour as to the benefit.
Yes, well, in Augusta County, where we are in Virginia, the average cow days per acre, and of course this would be very different in New Mexico, which has a lower rainfall, but it's all relative, okay? So where we are, the average is 80 cow days per acre. In other words, an acre will feed 80 cows for one day per year or one cow for 80 days per year.
I see.
80 cow days per acre.
And 80 on cow our days farm, per acre.
Yeah, and on our farm, we're averaging 400 cow days per acre, and we haven't planted a seed or bought a bag of chemical fertilizers in more than 50 years. So these systems, just blow away the lackadaisical management of other systems, which not only are lackadaisically managed, but then try to compensate with pharmaceuticals, chemical fertilizers, herbicides, pesticides, weed killers, and whatever.
Exactly. And has your results been, has the industry, the agribusiness industry and the government, for instance, have they taken notice as to some of the benefits and some of the successes that you've had?
No, not much. You got to remember that what we do puts money in the farmer's pocket, not in all the corporations that are supposed to supply the farmers with things that he needs.
Yeah, like the chemicals and all the stuff you don't need.
Yes, and all the machinery and concrete and fans and electricity and all that. So there's a huge prejudice in this country against actually solving problems. I mean, if we really got healthy, what would we do with the medical and the doctors and the pharmaceuticals and the insurance companies? They'd be looking for another line of work.
Well, and even finding a cure for cancer, just the American Cancer Society alone would be out of business.
So they
generate a lot of money. So you're right. Cures are not going to keep food on the table for those that are perpetuating the problem.
Yeah,
I got the clenched fist here for our final break, and I'm going to have to go to break right now, but we'll be back in just a moment, so stay tuned.
Don't you complicate your mind.
Welcome back one last time. This is Farron Dancer on Unicopia Green Radio, and this is our final segment here today with my guest, Joel Salatin, who's on the line from the Shenandoah Valley in Virginia, and we're talking about farming from an approach that is sustainable and holistic, and Joel has got an incredible amount of information. Joel, before the break, we were talking about how our culture is invested in really not finding solutions or not finding cures. And, of course, that is based on our corporate-driven mindset in this country where profit and selling more stuff, and in this case stuff we don't really need or stuff that is ultimately detrimental to the environment. And so that's why you haven't had the kind of support or feedback from the powers that be, as it were.
Sure. Yeah. If what we did, you know, where it's grass-based agriculture with almost zero sickness, no chemical fertilizers, very very little machinery. I'll give you one statistic: the average farm in America, it takes $4 worth of equipment and machinery to turn $1 in annual gross sales, and on our farm, it's 50 cents worth of equipment and machinery to turn $1 in annual gross sales. That's an 800% difference.
Mm-hmm.
One of the most dramatic ones that I ever saw was, 25 years ago, a bunch of health inspectors came in and told us our open-air chicken processing, was unsanitary. We had a test done and compared our chickens to the ones out of the supermarket. Mm-hmm. That were government inspected, And those averaged 3,600, they cultured the bacteria on the outside, and those averaged 3,600 colony-forming units of bacteria per milliliter to the second permutation, and I've already told you more than I understand. But anyway, that's how they measured
it. Certainly more than I understand.
Yeah, CFU per mil is how they measured it. And it, the store-bought ones cultured out an average of 3,600 on the samples, and ours averaged 133 CFU. That's 25 times less bacterial colonies. Now, when we presented that to the inspectors, wouldn't you think they'd have done black backflips and said, hey, stop all the industry, stop. We got a way here
to
have really clean chicken. Hold the presses, you know.
Yeah, hold the presses. We got a news story that's really worth printing here, right?
Yeah, exactly. But no, instead they said, well, there are other things that we need to worry about. I said, well, what? And they said, well, do you have a place to change uniforms for your employees? I said, we don't have any employees. They said, do you have bathrooms? I said, no, we're 50 feet from Mom's house and our house. Both of them have two bathrooms. If I want to go number one, I step behind the tractor. I mean,
a concept.
Yeah. It's all the food regulations are all about stainless steel, infrastructure spending.
Right.
If this actually were, became normal again, this kind of food production that I'm describing, that we do, uh-huh. It would completely invert the power, position, prestige, and profit of the entire food and farming industry in the U.S. You bet there's a lot of inertia to say what we do isn't credible, can't be done, is detrimental, to marginalize, demonize, and criminalize it.
So they marginalize, demonize, and criminalize what you do so they can avoid looking at all of what they do in that regard.
in so many words. Yeah, I mean, they even call us bioterrorists because we don't vaccinate our cows, and we don't, we let our chickens run out in the field where they might have fellowship with a red-winged blackbird or an indigo bunting, which then might take our diseases to the science-based Tyson, chicken houses, and threaten the planet's food supply with disease. I mean, this is the mentality that the industry has. So this is why we've come to the point where it is now safe to feed your kids Twinkies, Cocoa Puffs, and Mountain Dew, but it's unsafe to feed them raw milk, compost-grown tomatoes, and pastured chickens.
Yeah, exactly, and I've noticed now that what used to be oftentimes raw milk or even unprocessed orange juice is now coming to us, carrot juice, coming to us pasteurized, which means it's heated up to a certain temperature to obviously take away the bad stuff, but they take away all the good stuff with that as well, correct?
Yes, it completely changes the enzymes and the biological activity. Again, it's all done to create shelf life and sterility. And the fact is, you and I are not sterile. We each have 3 trillion bacteria inside of us.
Wow.
We are not sterile.
That's going to be tough to count, but I hear you. I mean,
there are 3 trillion of them, and so we are very far from sterile. It is that bacteria that allows us to survive, to live, to change the food we eat into cells and blood cells and things like that. So
kind of reminds me a little bit about how they've taken over this mindset with kids and in nurseries and stuff, and everything has to be Cloroxed and Lysoled and all kind, any germ or bacteria is removed from the environment, and then of course kids used to eat dirt, right? And that was like a kind of a good thing because you got some natural bacteria in your body.
Yeah, remember grandma saying every kid should eat a pound of dirt by the time they're 12?
Yeah, now it's like you eat a pound of Lysol because you don't want to be around a germ, right?
Yeah, so which is what is starting to create a tremendous backlash in our bodies with autoimmune deficiency problems, mm-hmm. because we don't have these mild exercises to exercise the immune system.
Right. So
that's what's creating this whole hygiene
hysteria.
Idea. Yeah, hygiene hypothesis that we're actually stimulating. And of course, you know, the New York Times bestseller Guns, Germs, and Steel talks about the reason the Western civilizations dominated the others was because of proximity to domestic livestock that built immunities to these diseases that wiped out the native, you know, the North American, South American native people groups and the Aborigines in Australia that did not have proximity to domestic livestock.
Wow. Well, so, you know,
so
Joel, I'm
so
sorry.
Yeah,
go ahead. I finish your thought, and then I'm going to have to go to break here one more time.
Yeah. So we are today, you know, creating a childhood without chores, without gardening, where our children can only sit in front of a, you know, in front of a TV monitor and wiggle their thumbs on a video game, and those children are growing up extremely immune deficient because they've never been exercised.
Yeah. Okay, well, Joel, I'm sorry we've run out of time. I've really enjoyed this. I want to thank you for being on the air with us today. And I want to invite the listeners to take in the Carbon Economy Series. Go to www.carboneconomyseries.com. Joel will be presenting on November 9th and 10th here in Santa Fe. And Joel, I'd like to get you back on the radio again at some point when we have a chance, because this is fascinating stuff. And best wishes on your endeavors.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for having me on.
My pleasure. And I want to invite the listeners to come back each and every Saturday here on Unicopia Green Radio. This is Farron Dancer, signing off.